It is very good to see you. And I mean that. It is very good to see you. Suffering, sin, the curse, God's wrath, His love, and His grace, all of these things are interwoven into the eternal plan of God. Think of it like a recipe. Mixed together, you find God's amazing plan to save a lost humanity. And you find this particular recipe present at major points throughout the Bible narrative. Adam and Eve dispelled from the garden. You have the great flood that destroyed the world. You have Sodom and Gomorrah. You have Israel in the wandering in the wilderness. You have the city of Jerusalem falling to the Babylonians. And then the greatest moment in man's history, the death of Jesus. All of these places throughout the Bible, you find these very things, this recipe, if you will, for God's holy purpose. However, you also find all of these things in His purpose in the lives of individuals as well. In the lives of you, in the life of me. So that when we do look at something that is as pervasive as suffering, how many times have we taken a trip down the road of suffering? Or would you even be fair to say that it's really just been one trip? The road hasn't ended. And that's sometimes how it feels. And as we looked at a couple weeks ago, sometimes an individual might suffer for the good of the whole. That in order to benefit many others, sometimes suffering falls just to one person. And we're quick to say, oh, I can accept that, unless I'm the one person. And you will rarely find a sermon on suffering without hearing one name in particular, Job. He is the poster boy of suffering. Job was just a guy living in a big world. And yet his suffering had a profound effect upon you and I as we go through our suffering. In fact, we learn things from Job that we don't learn anywhere else in the Scriptures. Many scholars put Job as a contemporary of Abraham, which makes him a 4,000-year-old example. Think about that. For 4,000 years, when somebody wanted a good example of someone who suffered, they look no further than Job. I mean, he's been the go-to example for a very long time. And one thing we learn from Job, it's never our body that's under attack. It's our life before God. It's never our body under attack. It's our life before God. Job lost so much. He lost his possessions. He lost his children. He lost his servants. Then he lost his health. I mean, he was a pitiful looking man just sitting on the ash heap, scraping his body with a broken piece of pottery. But is that what Satan really wanted? Did Satan just want to see Job suffer? Is that all Satan wanted? No. Satan didn't want Job's kids. He didn't want Job's possessions. Satan's end game was not to see Job sitting on the ash heap. Satan's end game was to get Job to turn away from God. Period. That's what we have to understand. Our body is never what's under attack. When we suffer, in whatever way, if Satan's involved, he has one purpose: to get us to leave the Lord. It's not that Satan wants to get you sick. It's not that Satan wants you to lose your stuff. He wants those things so that you will lose your soul. Plain and simple. And poor Job, as he is sitting on the ash heap, he is wrestling with, why did this happen? And we do the exact same thing. We think we can figure out why we're suffering. Or even worse, we think that we know why others are suffering. Be careful. Be careful. Because that may not only be a pompous attitude, that could be a very sinful one as well. As far as God's purpose goes, you don't know a thing about why he's doing what he's doing. And Job ponders. I mean, this poor man is just reasoning in his mind. He says, well, maybe the reason I'm suffering is ABC. No, that can't be it. Well, perhaps I'm suffering because of DEF. No, that doesn't make sense either. I mean, he just racked his brain trying to figure out why he suffered. But he just couldn't find a satisfactory answer. And that's the thing about the book of Job. We learn so much about suffering, but we still don't learn why. And as the account goes on, Job's friends come to comfort him. But they aren't very good at it, are they? In fact, some have argued that if those were Job's friends, what would his enemies look like? But in Job 22 and verse 3, this is what one of his buddies says. Is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous? Or profit if you make your ways perfect? Then another one of his friends in 35 verses 5 through 7. Look at the heavens and see, and behold the clouds, they are higher than you. If you have sinned, what do you accomplish against him? And if your transgressions are many, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give to him? Or what does he receive from your hand? I mean, what a thing to say to a man who's grappling for life in the wilderness. Job is being tested to his breaking point, and here are these guys spitting out their theology. I want you to take note, because I never really understood what they were saying here. But can you agree with their theology that God doesn't care at all how we humans respond? That regardless of what happens in the lives of men, God could care less what people do. Is that the God that you serve? That he doesn't care one way or another about how we live? You see the irony with this? What they're saying is that God has no purpose when it comes to man suffering. That suffering is pointless. And God doesn't give 2 cents to how we react when we suffer. I think what we learn here, or what we should learn, Job's friends knew nothing. Why? Because they couldn't see the purpose of God. And we can't either. But what we get with the book of Job, that we don't get anywhere else in the scriptures really, is a behind the scenes look. Where we actually do get a little perspective above the sun. We do get to see some of the things the way that God sees things. But while that may sound like we get more of an answer into the whys of suffering, we really don't. This behind the scenes look does not bring clarity to suffering, but rather it brings more complexity. And it's something we really need to think about, especially when we look at others who are suffering. One of the issues that we have as people is we cannot see into God's realm. And the only time that we can is when Scripture lets us have this behind-the-scenes look. So let's turn to the book of Job, if you will, chapter 1. Job chapter 1, and we're going to see this perspective that we really don't get anywhere else. Job chapter 1, starting at verse 6. Job chapter 1, and we'll start at verse 6. It reads, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil.' Then Satan answered the Lord, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now, and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse thee to thy face. Then the Lord said to Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him. So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. I don't know if you caught verse 12. Very similar wording to after the temptations of Christ. It says, and then he departed for a more opportune time. Notice what Satan does. He departs. But he'll be back. So we get to be, from reading this text, we get to be a part of this closed door meeting. And here is where we get a glimpse into suffering as far as God's purpose is concerned. But I'm going to tell you this. If you really want to read the Bible a different way, and don't strike me down for blasphemy, here's what I mean by that. If you take out this heavenly meaning, this heavenly meeting, if you take out all the interaction between God and Satan, then read the book of Job, and you will come away with a much different picture. In fact, it will look like God is torturing poor Job. But that's why Job is used as God's poster boy of suffering, because we do get this behind the scenes look. That's why Job is so important. We have this closed door heavenly meeting, and we get to listen in on it. And it's exactly that meeting that gives us an insight to suffering that we wouldn't have otherwise. And what we find is that God went to Job's defense because he believed in Job. It wasn't about Job believing in God. That was a given. I mean, there was no one as faithful as Job. But rather, the whole book is based on God believing in Job. And after all this is over, after all of the events of Job have concluded, I want you to imagine the dialogue that took place later on between God and Job. Maybe, perhaps Job says to God, Lord, whew, the way you treated me and let me suffer, it made it difficult for me to trust you. God says, oh, that's interesting, because the way you treated me before you suffered made it very easy for me to trust in you. Remember that with Job, Satan didn't pick him. God did. Out of the whole world's population, why Job? Because God was going to show Satan a thing or two. When Satan is involved with our suffering, what he wants is for us to leave God. He wants us to curse God's name. And when you see it like that, I mean, really, when you see it like that, God may just be saying, go ahead, Satan. You try making Malin suffer. You just try bringing trouble upon Linda. See what happens. They're not going to budge. You just wait and see. Sometimes our suffering is not so much to show God if we're faithful, but rather it shows Satan that we're faithful. God went to Job's defense because he believed in Job. God went to Job's defense not to discover if Job would remain standing, but to demonstrate that he would. God is telling the devil straight up, Satan, Job will not bend. You try as hard as you want to, but he will not curse me. We really do need to stop thinking that our suffering is just God punishing us. Who knows? Maybe there has been a heavenly council and your name's been brought up. That's something to think about, isn't it? Of all the symbols that God uses in Scripture to communicate with man, one of the most unique ones, I believe, is the burning bush. I think that's got to be one of the most intriguing things. Why did God choose a burning bush? Why did God use a bush on fire that didn't burn? Because people like Moses, And people like Job are burning bushes for God. They burn, but they are not consumed. And that's what we are. Those who are like Job, upright and blameless and fear God and turn away from evil. We are God's burning bushes, burned but not consumed. In Psalm 44 and verse 22, "But for thy sake we are killed all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered." Well, what that verse is about life on the ash heap. While Job was rich, and while he was generous and upright and living in a big house, Satan cursed him. Job was a thorn in Satan's eye, just like every godly person is. However, the bankrupt, diseased, lonely Job, who scraped his own sores raw, but still declared, "Blessed be the name of the Lord," that Job drove Satan crazy. It's hard to believe anything that Satan ever says. But even if he was speaking a shred of truth, maybe Satan really did believe that the only reason Job served God was because God gave him all this stuff. Regardless, when the events of Job were over with, I wonder if Satan learned some lessons. Maybe Satan learned that the truly God-fearing cannot be ripped away from the Lord that easily. Maybe Satan learned that for the upright and the righteous, even debilitating diseases can't separate someone from their Lord. We are burned but not consumed. I think Satan learned a lot from these events. I think he learned some hard lessons. But note, Satan accomplishes nothing for God, though God may accomplish much through Satan. Again, think about the dialogue that possibly could have taken place when the book is over. God may have said to Job, "Job, you were slandered by the deceiver, but I went to your defense. It wasn't your body under attack, Job. It was your integrity. It was your relationship with me. Job, I put you on the ash heap because I knew that you wouldn't disappoint me. I put you through grief, not because you were bad, but because you were good. And you can't know how proud I am of you, Job." Satan doesn't bring anything to the table for God. But yet God may use and accomplish things through Satan, like he did with Job. Sometimes, like Job, we suffer not because we are bad, but because we are good. Now, one of the things that helps us with Job and the whole account is that we've read the end of the story. Job didn't have the end of the story. It's easy for us to say, "Hang in there, Job. In the end, God's going to restore you and bless you and bring you up again." But Job didn't know that. For all he knew, he was going to live the rest of his life on this ash heap. So it would do us well to reread what Job suffered. So if you're still in Job chapter 1, we're going to ignore the chapter break here. But Job 1, starting at verse 13. "Now it happened on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, that a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people and they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' Then Job arose and tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground and worshipped, and he said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on the earth, blameless and upright man, fearing God, turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He'll curse thee to thy face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. His wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. One thing that I, right or wrong, that I have always tried to do with the book of Job is differentiate where the suffering came from. You ever do that with Job? Because you have obvious references where Satan brings that suffering upon Job, with God's permission, of course. But then you read other passages, like chapter 2, verse 3, where God says to Satan, "Although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." And then you read what we just read in verse 10, what Job says. When you read those things, where does the suffering seem to come from? It seems to come from God himself. But that's why. That's why, as we get more into this series about God's purpose and how he uses suffering and sin and the curse and wrath and love and grace, you see how they're all mixed together into his purpose. We just like to make our little charts. That's the problem. We like to categorize things and separate things. We like to reason things in our minds so that they make sense. Here's what we learn from the book of Job. Suffering doesn't make sense. In fact, that is God's very point at the end of the book. He says, "You can't understand all the ins and outs of my purpose, Job. So stop trying to figure it out." Suffering doesn't have to make sense to us, because it isn't about that. It's about us staying faithful. That's the message of suffering. Stay faithful. No, that doesn't explain suffering, but it doesn't have to. This poor man, look at what he lost. And look at how he lost these things. If you, since we all love our news feeds so much, if you were a reporter, you're a reporter for the ancient media, and you were in the land of Uz, and you're trying to get a story for the Babylon Gazette, can you imagine the headlines? "Rogue Sabaeans illegally cross border, steal livestock, kill servants." Or what about, "Freak lightning storm takes out entire field of sheep and shepherds. Chaldeans raid local farm, kill servants. Random tornado touches down, entire family lost." For us, under the sun, from our perspective of how we see events, we would see these events as completely random. That's why, if we didn't have that heavenly meeting recorded for us, the book of Job would look very different. Job's suffering would look random. But what looks random can in fact be the purpose of God, can it not? In the book of 1 Kings, it tells us that God purposed judgment to fall upon King Ahab. That was God's purpose. Judgment will fall on King Ahab. In 1 Kings 22:34, it says, "But someone," doesn't even say who, "but someone drew his bow at random and hit the king of Israel between the sections of his armor." what looked like a random arrow actually had God's purpose written all over it. God's control over things always brings about His purpose. Something like a tornado that blew down Job's house and killed all his kids. Everyone in this room knows how unpredictable tornadoes can be. Was that just bad luck for Job? I mean, would we just sit back and say, boy, did he have a bad day? The lightning that struck his crops and burned them all up, more bad luck? Think about how randomness can play into the matter of curses, but also into the matter of blessings. We insist on giving God credit for the blessing, right? We don't just smile and call it, well, good luck happened. When we're in a drought and it rains long and hard, we thank God who sends the rain, correct? Isn't that what we do? But when that same rain destroys our neighbor's home, we kind of push God out the side door so he won't get any bad press. And we'll just talk about, boy, that was random. Oh, that man just went through horrible luck. Before we know it, if we're not careful, we'll exclude God's control from his very purpose. God can accomplish his purpose by using what we call chance, whether we see it as good or bad. A freak accident on the highway, a slip in the tub, a stray bullet, and yes, in Job's case, even a disease. God has cursed creation, and he has subjected it to futility. Do you understand what that means? It means creation now serves purposes it was never created for. We need to stop arbitrarily saying, God's in control. Of course he is. Of course he's in control. But why is he in control? He's in control to bring about his purpose, to redeem his creation from sin, suffering, and futility. Yes, we learn a lot from the poster boy of suffering, but in the end, suffering still exists. And in the end, God's still in control. But here's my plea. Sometimes we think that we're such good Bible scholars that we have the answer for everything. Don't be like Job's friends and start spouting off your theology about why this guy over here sitting on the ash heap and this guy over here is really sick. You don't know. You don't know. God uses suffering for his purpose in the lives of people like you and I. So therefore, everything happens for his purpose, to his glory. And despite the suffering that goes on, we can't see behind the scenes. I want you to turn to the hymn of encouragement, please. We always offer heaven's invitation. And if the last couple years have proven anything, it's about how unpredictable things are. You just don't know what a day holds. But I hope that if you're here this morning or if you're watching online and you have not made that commitment to come to Jesus, to live a life for Him, because in this crazy world, it's the only life that makes sense. To be baptized into the blood of Jesus, to become that new creation, to walk humbly with our God, that's the only kind of life there is to live. This past week, lost a good man. We lost a good man. His name was D. Bowman. And he was the reason that I got into preaching. But at the end of so many of his sermons, he said the same thing. If you miss heaven, you just missed all there is. Let's sing this last hymn.